It's Thursday. Welcome to it. I'm Jason Page. Don't mind me. Final show of the week. In case you didn't miss it, I said it earlier in the week. We're going to go Monday through Thursday throughout the summer. Then once the NFL kicks back into gear, we'll be with you Monday through Friday. We got a busy show, a lot to squeeze into 60 minutes. We'll be joined by Patrick McEnroe in about 30 minutes, the ESPN tennis analyst. Get his thoughts on the return of Serena Williams to Wimbledon at the age of 40. So, if you haven't done so yet, I want you to make sure you subscribe to our YouTube channel, the Decibel 88 channel. Also, make sure to give us a like if you are enjoying what you're watching on the show, too. In addition, make sure you subscribe to the Don't Mind Me podcast, courtesy of our friends at Believe. That's B-L-E-A-V. You can find it everywhere. Spotify, all those usual places. We're there. So make sure to do that as well. We'll also get into the budding controversy around the NFL concerning Daniel Snyder. Yesterday, Roger Goodell was in front of Congress, well, virtually anyway, and pretty much showed that either he's a bold-faced liar, which I don't think is the case here, or he's really a lot more powerless than a lot of us think, that he's kind of neutered by NFL ownership. And it really does go to show the difference between the way the NFL runs and polices itself versus the way the NBA does. I'll get into that coming up in a few minutes. I talked a little bit about it yesterday as well. Start with the Stanley Cup final and controversy. Big controversy. When, you know, you get a game-winning goal. I mean, it really is amazing. The Avalanche beat the Lightning last night 3-2 in overtime. And let's be clear, by the way, if anybody watched the overtime of this game, the Lightning were clearly gassed. I mean, the Avalanche were getting opportunity after opportunity, and eventually they cash one in and they win. But should the goal have counted? That's what a lot of people are talking about this morning. Now, I'm not going to pretend that I'm some guy that watches tons of the NHL. Anybody who knows me knows, of the four major sports, it's not the one I watch the most of. In fact, it's the least. But last night, after the Yankee game ended, I flipped over to ABC just in time to catch the end of regulation and then overtime. And in the overtime, you could see Colorado had the fresher legs. And again, this goes back to something we talked about before the series started, and that is the fact Colorado's played a lot less games than Tampa Bay has and put themselves in a position where they're very well rested. And you get into that overtime last night, and you could see the fresher legs, the fresher team was the Colorado Avalanche. So they get the game-winning goal, and a lot of people didn't even know the puck went into the net because it went into the top of the net, and it looked like it might have been on top of the net. So I kind of felt bad for Sean McDonough because he didn't even get to have that Stanley Cup final moment where you get that great overtime goal score call. None of that. Because nobody knew the puck was in the net. And after the game, John Cooper, who is the head coach of the Tampa Bay Lightning, for those of you that are not familiar with hockey or big fans of hockey, John Cooper took to the podium. And I want you to take a listen to what he had to say, because he wasn't very happy and he wasn't in the mood to take many questions.
John, how disappointing was it to get out of that first period with just one goal? And did that push maybe take a little bit out of you as that game went on?
I don't know. I thought we had a really strong first. We had the lead. You know, I love this league. It's the greatest league in the world. The people that run it are amazing. Everything about it, it's like a dream come true for me, especially being a Canadian kid growing up and everything that's gone on. And a lot of times when you're, you know, I've been part of some heartbreaking losses and defeats to teams that took us out, and been with a group that just fights and fights and fights, and they fought their way to a third Stanley Cup final in a row. And in a cap era when it's so damn hard and the rules are put against you because they, you know, the league wants parity. And I love that about the league. And that's what makes it tougher. And this, just watch this team, what they've gone through and the battling that's gone on, and we're all in this together, players, coaches, refs, everybody. But it just this one's going to sting much more than others, just because I think it was taken on, it was potentially, I don't know, it's hard for me. This is going to be hard for me to speak. I'm going to have to speak. I'll speak with you tomorrow. You're going to see what I mean when you see the winning goal. And my heart breaks for the players, because we probably still should be playing. I'll be available tomorrow.
And that was it. John Cooper, nothing more to say. And after further review by analysts, the TV cameras, all of that stuff, because there's angles on all of this stuff, the Avalanche had six men on the ice. Now, some will argue, and I heard PK Subban make this point this morning on ESPN, I believe it was, and basically said, well, it wouldn't have impacted the fact that they scored the goal. They shouldn't have called six men on the ice. But by the law and by the rule and by the rules of the NHL, they had six men on the ice. The goal shouldn't have counted. And this is not a reviewable play. And this is where it gets into, I mean, look, you could have all the instant replay in the world. You know, in baseball now, we're talking about robotic umpires. The NBA, you've got your one challenge. But in a Stanley Cup final, how is any goal not reviewable? It's the game-ending goal in overtime. How are you not reviewing it automatically? And my buddy Eric Peterson said it this morning in a text to me. And I said it to myself last night. I said, it should be just like the NFL. All scoring plays are reviewed, period. Full stop. You could do it fast. It's not like there's a zillion goals scored. How is that not reviewable when you're talking about a pivotal game in this series? The difference between 2-2 potentially and 3-1, and who knows? Look, maybe the Avalanche win the game anyway. They were putting tons of pressure on Vasilevsky in the overtime period. So who knows? Maybe they score anyway. But it's the point that's not even reviewable. I'll bet you it will be next year. Which gets me to the bigger point here. You know, we often lament the fact that we're a reactive society. Politics, you name any matter that you want to bring to the forefront in your politics and legislation. We're always talking about the fact that we're reactive rather than proactive. When do we try to stop a gun crime? After the last one has occurred. When do we try to stop drunk driving? After the last person's been run over or killed in a drunk driving crash. When does the NFL make a rule change about overtime and making sure both teams get the football once? After Kansas City and Buffalo play a classic. When does Major League Baseball change, you know, a rule on home runs and whether they could be reviewed after a controversial home run? Nobody has foresight. I'm not saying you got to be some genie and be able to look into some clairvoyant and be able to look into something before it happens. I'm not saying that. But you have to have some forward vision, some forward thinking. And this is a simple one. Playoffs, all goals get reviewed. Why is that difficult? That doesn't take a rocket scientist. And it just goes to show that sports organizations aren't any different. They're not any different from our local, state, federal governments, employers, all of these things that tend to be reactive rather than proactive. The NHL will change this rule, and it will be too late for a Tampa Bay Lightning team that's trying to do something historic in winning a third straight Stanley Cup. And they may have lost out because last night might have been the backbreaker in this series. And again, they might have lost the game anyway, but that's not the point. You play an entire season. You play damn near 100 games. Probably with preseason, you are playing 100 games. Guys are leaving it all out there. You got a goalie standing on his head in overtime. And you can't take an extra minute after a goal that ends the game, makes it a 3-1 series. You can't take an extra minute to review it. And then the conspiracy theorists are going wild because on the original score sheet put out to the media after the game, it actually recognizes that six people were on the ice for the Colorado Avalanche when the game-winning goal was scored. They actually put out a sheet that said, here's who was on the ice when the goal was scored. And then they got rid of it and put out a new one. So that's not going to help the NHL in terms of its image here. But for all intents and purposes, you got to feel like that's the end of this series. You saw the way the Avalanche manhandled Tampa Bay in the first two games of this series back in Denver. Be surprised if this thing doesn't end up with a Colorado Avalanche Stanley Cup victory at some point here over the next few days. I said I'll get to some NFL stuff concerning Roger Goodell and the badly behaved Washington Commanders, formerly the Redskins, and their ownership, and their owner in particular, Daniel Snyder. We'll get to that coming up in a few minutes. But I also want you to hear from Jay Monahan, in his own words, the man that runs the PGA Tour, because the PGA Tour is starting to feel the pressure from LIV Golf. And you'll be able to hear from Jay Monahan in his own words about how all that is sort of festering itself. And Jay Monahan was very blunt yesterday in a press conference at the Travelers Championship back in my old stomping grounds in Connecticut. We'll hear some of what he had to say as well. I'm Jason Page. Don't mind me. If you haven't clicked the like button, do it. If you haven't subscribed to the show, do it. Patrick McEnroe is coming up a little later on. We'll talk some tennis with him. Wimbledon right around the corner. He's getting set to head out to London. Get some thoughts with him on the return of Serena Williams at the age of 40. Does she have a chance to win? We'll talk to him about that and much more as we continue. Don't mind me. On this Thursday, I'm Jason Page. Stay with us. We welcome you back. Don't mind me. I'm Jason Page. Thanks for being with us on this Thursday. Always, you know, it's always interesting. You never know what stories are going to sort of pop up as you go through a week. And the one constant that's been going on throughout this week is what's taking place with Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour, where you've got the PGA Tour commissioner basically out here trying to sort of stem the blood flow, because it feels like a real gushing wound here for Jay Monahan and the PGA Tour with all these defections that are taking place right now. And look, he is trying to figure out an answer to keep these guys from defecting to the LIV Golf Tour, which is obviously run by the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, whatever they want to call it. But, I mean, Jay Monahan did not mince words on Wednesday when he met with the media at the Travelers Championship. And I want you to hear from him in his own words, because this is a guy that sounds like he's very much in touch with the situation, but it also sounds like he's sort of stuck in between when it comes to solutions. Listen.
Let me be clear. I am not naive. If this is an arms race, and if the only weapons here are dollar bills, the PGA Tour can't compete. The PGA Tour, an American institution, can't compete with a foreign monarchy that is spending billions of dollars in an attempt to buy the game of golf. We welcome good, healthy competition. The LIV Saudi Golf League is not that. It's an irrational threat.
Wow. You know, and wait, look, I've been to the Travelers Championship a zillion times. You never see the commissioner of the PGA Tour giving press conferences there like this. So you know that this is real right now. And yesterday, Brooks Koepka backed out of the Travelers Championship, which he was supposed to play in, because he's a coward and he doesn't want to answer questions. I mean, that's the reality of it. And I'd say that's Brooks Koepka if he was standing right here. It's cowardly. It's gutless. Monahan wasn't done there.
Listen, every player that's left, I'm going to say I have great admiration and respect for the contributions that they've made to the PGA Tour. And I'm disappointed that, you know, that Brooks Koepka has left and has joined the LIV Golf Series. I haven't had a chance to talk to him about it, and I look forward to having a conversation with him, but I'm not going to share any more than that at this point in time.
You almost wonder, though, and look, I'm not trying to, I'm not trying to do anything that'll sort of give cover to these guys who have bolted for the LIV Tour and basically made the money grab. That's not what I'm doing. But it makes you wonder if there are, and I don't know what the relationship is like between the guys on the PGA Tour and Jay Monahan, how, you know, if he glad hands these guys, if he's trying to make them feel welcome, if he's sort of embraced them. I have no idea. No idea at all. If that's what Jay Monahan does. But there almost seems to be some level of vindictiveness here from the Mickelsons of the world, from the certainly from the Sergio Garcias of the world. You know he's not happy with the tour. But Brooks Koepka and Bryson DeChambeau and all these guys that have opted for the money rather than the tour that has helped them amass their millions over the years, it almost feels like there is something more here that we don't understand or know about. And I don't know what that is. We talked to Jason Sobel earlier this week. He didn't reference it at all. We talked to Damon Hack about it a week or so ago. He didn't seem to know what the logic behind it was other than the money grab. But you almost feel, I mean, if you're Brooks Koepka, you didn't even talk to the guy that runs the tour that you play on before bolting and skipping town. That just seems odd to me. Either Brooks Koepka is a complete coward and a gutless jellyfish, or there's something more at play here as it relates to the relationship between Jay Monahan and these guys on the tour. What would make them do this? I mean, would they have done this to Tim Fincham back in the day when he was running the tour? I don't know. When we have Patrick McEnroe on, I'm asking him about, what if something like this takes place in tennis? I mean, the only other real comparison you can make to what the Saudis are doing with golf would be tennis. It's a very similar sport, independent contractors, a especially when you talk about the prize purses in tennis not being that big, and maybe players looking for more money. What if the Saudis decided, hey, this model works, let's do it for tennis too? A quick thought from football before we get back to some other things I want to talk about, and before we get to Patrick McEnroe. Quick thought from football, where you have this situation with Daniel Snyder, who didn't appear before a House Oversight Committee yesterday. Now, we could sit here and debate all day the politics of, should Washington, D.C., should our nation's legislators be taking on the topic of the workplace environment of the Washington Commanders? Should they? I know a lot of people are going to argue, and I know Republicans did yesterday, that this isn't even a topic that's meant for or geared towards Congress. But it's within their purview, it's within their jurisdiction, so they decided to have a big old dog and pony show yesterday on Capitol Hill. And Roger Goodell appeared via, virtually. And he really didn't have much to say in terms of taking action against Daniel Snyder, because he basically said, hey, we're not in a position to fire, we're not in a position to fire or get rid of Daniel Snyder as owner of the Commanders. That's essentially what you got from Roger Goodell yesterday. He essentially said, we're not allowed to make an owner sell the team. Only fellow owners can do that. Listen to some of the questioning for Roger Goodell yesterday.
Is Dan Snyder's behavior and the workplace culture he created and fostered one of the worst and most toxic you've seen in your time as commissioner?
I have not seen a workplace in the NFL that is anywhere near what we saw in the context of that period of time for the Washington Commanders.
Today on Capitol Hill, the head of arguably...
So there you go. I mean, Roger Goodell basically told you that he had never seen a workplace environment this bad. Now, if this were the NBA, Adam Silver would be forcing Daniel Snyder to sell the team. But for some reason, the way the NFL is set up is essentially that Roger Goodell is at the beck and call of owners, and he doesn't have the authority to force Daniel Snyder to sell the team. And that's a big, big problem. That's a big, big problem when you're essentially a commissioner with no teeth and the good old boys club that welcomes a Daniel Snyder into it are the ones responsible for getting him out of it. And all of these guys probably got dirt on each other. They all know where the bodies are buried. Remember, the NFL is also the same league that has buried thousands of emails between Bruce Allen, John Gruden, people within the Commanders organization, the way they were talking about women. This league has not been transparent in how it's conducted itself as it relates to this matter. And quite honestly, with the rules the way they are, and these leagues allowed to operate however they damn well please, that's unlikely to change. And nobody's going to go after the antitrust exemption, so the NFL's just going to keep doing what it wants. And most of all, the biggest reason they can do it is the fans don't care. You don't care. You don't care about the toxic workplace environment for the Washington Commanders. All you care about is your fantasy team and who you bet on Saturday, Sunday, Thursday, or Monday. And we've seen that time and time again. We'll come back and hear from Patrick McEnroe. So don't mind me. I'm Jason Tatum. So we welcome in Patrick McEnroe. Does a great job with ESPN. You'll see him for a couple of weeks over at Wimbledon, where he's getting set to head off to. I'm glad I'm able to get you on, Patrick, because I want to start with Serena. I know you're more on the men's side, but I think everybody's got an opinion and a thought on what she's trying to do here at the age of 40. She gets a wild card entry into this year's tournament. I guess I'll start with this, and it might not be a question you can answer. What do we know about the last year of her life and what kind of work she's even been putting in to try and get to where she can be just competitive at Wimbledon? Because like Tiger Woods, I don't think she's doing this on ceremony. I don't think she's doing this for bleeps and giggles. I think she's going out there, and she's the type of competitor that she's going out there, she's trying to win.
Well, first of all, Jason, it's great to be on with you. It's been a while, too long, so I'm very happy to be on. Second of all, I do cover quite a bit of the women because, you know, I sort of go into multiple roles at ESPN. So I do color. I do play-by-play. I host the studio. So I have actually the last couple
of years. All right, fine. You know everything about the women.
More women's tennis, all right? As for Serena, we're learning slowly a little bit more because during the last year, which is the last time we saw her play, unfortunately, when she limped off the court, had that horrendous injury on center court at Wimbledon. So she hasn't played since then. She did, you know, she wasn't giving too many press conferences or too much information about what she'd been doing. She was selling a lot on QVC. And her own business is, you know, continuing to blossom. And so good for her that she's doing seemingly quite well with that. But we did learn from her this week in one of her press conferences that she said after she pulled out of the U.S. Open last year that she realized she wasn't going to play there, that she basically didn't do anything for a couple, you know, I don't know how long that was for, but it sounded like at least through the end of 2021. And when I say anything, like no fitness, no nothing, because even when she had other sabbaticals from tennis or hiatuses or had injuries, you kind of get the sense that even if she wasn't playing a lot of tennis, she was still working out a bit, you know, keeping herself in shape. So it sounds like she didn't do that at all for a while. Now, when that restarted, I'm guessing probably at some point earlier in the year. But a good question, like, why is she coming back? My guess is, as you said, she believes she can still be competitive. Knowing Serena, she probably still thinks she could win it, which I don't think she could do without having played at all. But she is Serena, so anything's possible. But I'm also thinking that she didn't want to leave Wimbledon the way she left it last year. You know, having to be sort of carried off the court and, you know, early in the tournament. So whether she thinks she can win it, if you gave her true serum, I'd be surprised if she said, yes, she believes she could win it this year. But, you know, she certainly, I think, wants to go out and be able to win a couple of matches and feel good about her Wimbledon experience this year. And then maybe see where it goes from there if she wants to continue to try to train and get back to where she could play the U.S. Open and then sort of ramp it up for the beginning of next year, because she's always done well at the Australian Open. I mean, she loves going down there. So I could see her, you know, gearing up for the U.S. Open and then sort of playing again in Australia and seeing how it goes. But I really don't expect her, Jason, to be a huge factor in the second week of the tournament.
Wow. Do you think she makes it to the second week?
You know, we'll have to see the draw because she's going to be unseeded. I would say no. Sure. I mean, I'd be surprised. I mean, there's, you know, Swiatek has obviously dominated the women's tour since Barty retired after winning the Australian Open. And of course, she won Wimbledon last year, Barty. Swiatek is not as big of a favorite on grass as she was on clay at the French Open. That being said, I think she's distanced herself from the pack. Now, the pack is getting stronger in women's tennis, meaning, you know, you go down the list. So there's players now that are ranked 50, 60, 90 that could pick Serena off.
Really?
You know, whereas in the past, that I don't think that was the case at all. obviously, if she can get through the first couple of matches, you know, with each match she wins, she gets more of a threat because her confidence will grow. I watched a little bit of the – I didn't see the doubles today. They won again, her and Anja Bor, who's certainly one of the players that I think could win the tournament. So she picked a good partner. they won a little bit easier today. Yesterday, I watched a bit of the match. You know, Serena looked rusty. I mean, understandable, particularly going to play on grass that's much softer grass than you have at Wimbledon, meaning the ball bounces lower. It's not as clean of a hit you're going to get on it. So good for her and Ons that they were able to win again today and give Serena sort of another practice match, albeit it's in doubles.
Is there anything you see in her game from the past? Obviously not now, but just those certain things that she carries, even with the rust that might be on it. When you look at the rest of the women's field, and I know you said it's deeper now, it's better than it was when she left the game even a year ago. Is there an argument you can make for her going on some sort of magical run, or is it just a complete pipe dream?
Well, I think it's a little bit like Tiger when he played the Masters. You know, we thought like Tiger, okay, if he could get, you know, he did well for the first, 2 days, had one very good day. And then the body caught up to him. So again, you never underestimate greatness, Jason. So you don't underestimate Tiger because he's Tiger, and you don't underestimate Serena. That being said, I think it's a long shot. Is it a longer shot? If it would be a much longer shot if she wasn't Serena. She was just some player, you know, that had been a top 10 player and came back. I mean, this is a full year. That's like an eternity in professional tennis to not have played a match. Again, Serena's played a lot of matches in her life. We know that. But even for someone at her level, to come back and do this would be it would be remarkable.
Is just the stamina
get to the second week.
It is even just the stamina the toughest part. I mean, as somebody that played the game at a high level, obviously, is it the stamina that will be the most difficult for her if she gets pushed to a third set? Could the rust fester itself that way more than any place?
I think it's more in her case the quick movement. You know, because she's 40 now, her movement certainly slowed down over the years. Understandable. That happens to everybody. So the endurance, you know, on grass, the points are a little bit quicker. She's got the greatest serve in the history of women's tennis. It didn't look that great in the doubles, but it looked, you know, that she could get back pretty quickly. It's like a great pitcher. You know, obviously you got to build your arm strength, but if you have a fastball, you're always going to have a fastball. You're going to be able to get it back. So that she could get back. Endurance definitely could be a factor. But I think the bigger factor is the movement, the quick movement, the quick steps, the timing, which on grass is more difficult than, you know, the bounces. It is clean. It's not as sure, even though the Wimbledon grass has gotten a lot better. So she's not going to get that pure predictable bounce that she would get on a hard court, for example. So you have to be nimble. You have to be able to move quickly, particularly in the first couple of days when the grass is quite soft, the ball stays lower, the footwork is not as sure. That's why we've seen a lot of injuries, including hers last year, of players early in the tournament. So I think that part is actually more difficult for her. Remember, the women play 2 out of 3. So there's no best of 5. That's, you know, where endurance becomes even a bigger issue. So the short answer is, do I think it's a factor? Yes. I don't think it's the most important factor, though, for Serena. I think it's timing and movement.
There was one last one on Serena, and then I'll get to the men. There was a time when, to go back to Tiger Woods for a second, players used to be tired of always having to answer questions about Tiger, you know, his competitors. That changed after his absence for a long time, and then he came back, and then players appreciated more what he brought to the game and what he meant to the game. But there was a time where people just got sick and tired of having to answer questions about him. Is that the case on the women's side? Well, are the other women in the field going to bristle about having the answers questions about Serena? Or do you get the sense that now where she is in the game, an elder statesman of the game, that they appreciate what she's done for the sport?
Yeah, I think it's much more the latter. And I think that's a great question. And I think that's absolutely, and I think there is certainly some jealousy over the years, right? Because Serena, And she's so damn good. And she was so dominant. But I think there are other stories have picked up with some other players. And I think that having Serena come back is actually welcome for a lot of the players, maybe partly because, Jason, they're not as threatened by her as they would have been in the past. Like, oh, here comes Serena. We're all playing for second. That's not the case anymore. I think it's more of Serena's coming back. It's good for the tournament. It's good for the game. You know, Anjabor even, you know, was joking. She was saying to other players, you know, I'm not going to consider playing doubles with you unless you have at least 20 majors to your name. So I think there's that, you know, that appreciation of what Serena has done, who she is, and bringing a little more buzz to the game. Because you know, we all know tennis needs it, you know, whether it's men's tennis or women's tennis. And especially with the Russian, Belarusian issue, can't play at Wimbledon. Medvedev, Sabalenka, who certainly could have been one of the favorites to win it. She made the semis this year. So I think it's a positive that Serena's coming back from the perspective of the other players. But I think that, as I said earlier, I also think they don't quite feel it's the same Serena on the court. So they're sort of celebrating who she is without being as worried, oh, Serena's going to come and just win the tournament. I don't think most of the players believe that.
I get that it's grass, and we're talking about Patrick McEnroe of ESPN. And we know Novak Djokovic's success there. But how is he seated? To the layperson looking at this, they say, how is he seated ahead of Rafael Nadal when the latter's won the first two majors, the first two slams of the year, and Djokovic didn't even play the Australian, hasn't played nearly as much. I mean, I get why. I get the grass and that he's so good there and he's been so successful.
No, but hold on, though, but that's not why he's seated ahead of him.
So why is he seated ahead of him?
Because he's ranked ahead of him.
But okay, but even to that point, how is he ranked ahead of him?
Well, I have to explain the computer system.
Don't. Yeah, don't play my head.
Okay. Well, he's a better grass court player. So actually, I argued before the French Open that Nadal should have been moved up because all the tournaments now go strictly by the book.
Right. That started only in 2021 with Wimbledon, though, right?
Yeah, Wimbledon had in the past gone by a more
pay attention to this stuff.
Yeah, I see that. I like that. So in this case, I would argue, I mean, Djokovic has won six Wimbledons, including the last couple. Nadal's won two, which is pretty darn good, too.
In a whole bunch of finals.
A couple, not a whole bunch. He's had a lot of early exits. By far, he's most vulnerable on grass, but that's another story. The reason is that the tournaments have, you know, and again, I was blasted the French for not moving Nadal at least up to three or four. He was seeded five, which was ridiculous. Now, the reason why is because their ranking is lower. Because in the case of Nadal, he was hurt the whole second half of last year. In the case of Djokovic, he didn't play the Australian Open, which he's won upteen times, nine times to be precise. And he missed a lot of other big tournaments because he wouldn't take the vaccine. So that's why, he's actually not even ranked one. Medvedev's ranked one. You want to go crazy about something else, the guy, you know, won the U.S. Open, but done basically nothing this year. He did make the final. I shouldn't say nothing. He made the finals in Australia. And Zverev's ranked two, and he's out because of an injury. They're 1-2 in the world. So if you want to go crazy about the rankings, Jason, go crazy about the fact that those guys are 1-2. And if they were playing, Djokovic would be the three seed, which would be absurd because he should be the one seed. He's by far the favorite on grass. And Nadal, you know, thank goodness he won the French because that and those other two guys are out because otherwise he could be seeded four or five.
All right. Who's I have to claim ignorance here.
But the ranking system, just so you know.
Yeah.
It goes by the last 12 months.
Yeah, I know.
It's not just the calendar year.
Yes.
And that's you can either, you know, disagree with that or not. But that's always been the way it's been in tennis.
I mean, but would you say right now? If you were ranking today, is Rafael Nadal, would he be the number one player in the world?
For 2022, absolutely.
Yes.
No doubt. But the rank, we in tennis, see, we don't go by just, because if you did that, then, you know, the beginning of the year, I actually think that tennis should go more the golf route, which is they take multiple years. I actually think it's not good that they do just 12 months in the past. You know, it's a rolling system. So in other words, you lose your points from the, like Wimbledon, the players will lose their point. Although that's another, you know, cluster F, you know what that is, because they're not going to give ranking points because the ATP and the WTA stripped the ranking points from Wimbledon because they banned Russian and Belarusian players. So there are plenty of issues going on.
I've got one more thing I want to ask you about, but first this, I'll claim ignorance. He has the second best odds to win, according to the sports books. Who's Matteo Berrettini and why should I care?
Well, he got to the final last year.
Okay.
He's an Italian. He's got
remember him in the final last year.
Yeah. He took a set off Djokovic. He just won one of the big warm-up tournaments at the Queen's Club for the second year in a row. Look, it's always been the same with Nadal at Wimbledon, Jason. If he can get through the first couple rounds when the conditions are very for him, because he's got the big swings and the return is his vulnerable spot. If he can get to week two, when the courts get harder, the bounce gets truer, the footing gets better, then he becomes a legitimate threat to win it. But in week one, he's very vulnerable. And so that's why you've got if Berrettini plays his best on grass in week one and would play Nadal, he'd beat him. If they played in week two, when the conditions are a little bit different, the pressure a little greater, you know, then it's actually probably an even match with just the two of them head to head on grass, only on grass. So that's why Berrettini's the second favorite. Hubert Hurkacz from Poland, who made the semis also last year. Excellent grass court player. He's another guy that people are talking about that could make a big run. But I mean, Djokovic, the difference for Djokovic, Jason, at Wimbledon than the US Open or Australian Open, okay, which are the other two ones he'd be the favorite at, is there are fewer guys that can beat him on grass than there are in hard court. Like there's not that many guys that play really well on grass. There's only a handful. We just mentioned a couple of them. So Djokovic, to me, at this stage of his career, is a bigger favorite at the Wimbledon than any other major.
I can't let you go without asking you about this because I was thinking about you this morning. Maybe your ears were ringing. I was thinking about this whole LIV Golf thing. And we know how it's affecting golf and fracturing the golf world and the PGA Tour and guys defecting. And the women's game is wondering what it's going to mean for them. The only sport I could really equate it to in that regard is tennis.
Yep.
In that, again, you know, you look at these prize purses, and we've talked about this before, you and I, the amount of money that tennis players make versus golfers. I mean, it's not even close when you put the numbers
together. When you go down the list.
Right, when you go down the list.
Yeah, at the very top, the tennis players make more. But once you go from 5 down to 200,
right,
more for golfers, yeah.
Is there talk around the tennis world about, hey, what if something like this were to happen for tennis? Is it something that they would be more open towards? I mean, what's to stop the Saudis next from saying, hey, we got enough money for this, let's do the same with tennis?
Yeah,
I mean, is there a thought around the tennis world about this?
Well, this has come up in years past, and it wasn't the Saudis and people throwing a bunch of money at them, but it was I'll try to be brief because it's a bore your listener. Okay, the ITF, which oversees the four majors, okay, the four Grand Slams, Australian Open, French Open, Wimbledon, US Open, similar to golf. Right. They oversee those events, but the Grand Slams can, like in golf, can basically do whatever they want. Like as we saw with Wimbledon, they can just make their own rules. Okay. And because they offer so much prize money, because they're so prestigious, the tours and the players sort of have to go along. But in the past, when the ATP, which is a governing body for the men's tour, has had a conflict with the majors or a particular major, the majors have threatened. Okay, to start their own tour, the majors, because the majors could go to, you know, it's the USTA, the US Federation, the All England Club, they give money to the British Federation, the French Federation, and the Australian Federation. So they could easily pick off the Italian Federation, which runs Rome, the German Federation, which runs Hamburg and, right, you know, other tournaments. So they could, not easily, but they could do that. There's never been a sort of another entity other than an event that I was actually lucky enough to play in way back in the 90s when tennis was huge in Germany, called the Grand Slam Cup, which was a top 16 finishers in the four majors in the year. So the short answer to the question is, for the good of tennis, I'd sort of like to see it happen because I'd like to see there be more money and more sponsorship in tennis, because the average tennis player, I'm not going to say struggles, but doesn't make like huge money other than the top tier players. And I would like to see the money funnel down a little bit more. The majors have tried to do that over the years. But again, as with everything, Jason, comes down to pure economics. And if someone's willing to write some huge checks to some top tennis players and then some journeyman tennis players like yours truly back in the day, I'd say, where do I go? Sign me up.
Yeah, I just wonder how, again, the ATP and WTA would react versus what we've seen in the PGA Tour with Jay Monahan basically saying, you're with us or against us, that sort of mentality.
I mean, that would be like a third tour. So it would be very interesting to see how that played out. But at the moment, Jason, tennis has far too many other issues to deal with. Then to me, that's like a prosperity issue in golf. You know, the fact that this tour started because, it's not oversaturated and tennis is struggling, you know, the mid to low tier events on the main tours struggle to make ends meet and to financially be viable. That's the biggest problem in tennis. It's so top heavy with the majors. And then you've got the big events like yours, the one out in the desert, the BNP Paribas Open. Those events are great, do extremely well. But those are 9 to 10 other events outside the majors.
Patrick McEnroe, you'll see him on ESPN over the next couple of weeks. If you're not tired of his face now, you will be by then.
Thanks, Jason.
Hey, by the way, take care of that dog back there. Is it alive? Can we prove that? Can I have proof of life here?
See how chill he is? He's so chill, man.
If I could put a bubble above its head right now, I'd be saying WTF.
My first and only son, Pepper McEnroe.
I love it. Patrick, good to see you, my friend.
All the good. All the best, Jason. Thanks for having me.
It's always good to talk to Patrick McEnroe, and appreciate him joining us on the show. Just able to get him before he flies off to London for Wimbledon. The best bet yesterday was... There we go. We'll get the right screen up. The best bet yesterday was the Yankees on the money line -140, which was a winner. That means I am two in a row. Means two in a row. Lost the first three. Now we've won the last two. So we're feeling pretty good. I meant to get a picture of it, which won't help you guys listening on the podcast, courtesy of Believe. But if you didn't get a chance to see it, I'm a huge dog nut. You'll probably see my dog running around in the background somewhere during the course of this show. But I'm a huge dog guy. And last night at the Westminster Kennel Club dog show, Chris Myers was doing the play-by-play for it, by the way, which I thought was kind of funny. You know, for years, that event was on USA, and we always used to watch it when I was a kid. And now it's on Fox Sports, so FS1 had it on last night. The bloodhound named Trumpet was the winner. The bloodhound named Trumpet was the winner. I should bring my dog over. Just let him come over and say hello. Come here, Dookie. Come here. Come here. Come on over. No? All right. You don't want to come over. But a bloodhound, it was the first time that a bloodhound had ever won best in show at the Westminster Kennel Club dog show. And the guy who was doing the judging for the dog show actually made a little speech before announcing who the winner was. And he said, do me a favor and hug your dog. So that's the advice I'm going to give you guys as we say goodbye for this week. Hug your dog. If you have one. And if you don't, hug the next closest thing to your dog. Whatever that would be. Dogs are the greatest. They bring out the very best in all of us. My guy Dookie, he is my world. I told you the Yankees were going to win. I told you it was the best bet. Hopefully you made some money. We're back with you on Monday. We're with you all the time, courtesy of the Believe Podcast Network. Go and download the podcast, subscribe to it, sign up, all that good stuff. Who knows where we'll be on Monday? The NHL season might be officially over. If the Avalanche could wrap things up at home. We got to talk about some of these great young players in Major League Baseball, too. I think we'll do that next week. It really seems like the golden age for baseball with all these guys that have been called up. All right, that does it for me. Have a great weekend. Stay safe. I'm Jason Page. Don't mind me. Catch you back here next time. Bye.